Thanks for tuning in to our podcast series, Scaling Without Borders. As a pan-European PR agency, we've supported many companies in their journey to expand to other markets. In this series, we take a deep dive into how scale-ups can grow their business beyond their home country. We'll shed a light on this challenge from different perspectives. Entrepreneurs who have already successfully done this, the investor community funding these ambitious people, and the startup ecosystem supporting them. This first season, we focus on the Dutch scale-up community. What are their insights on how to scale abroad successfully? All to inspire other entrepreneurs to perhaps do the same. Hello and welcome to Scaling Without Borders. In this series, we interview some of Europe's leading experts in the startup community to learn from their experience and understand their vision on how to successfully grow a startup or scale up across borders. In today's episode, we are joined by Wiebe Wagemans. Wiebe is a Dutch pioneer in the AI and mobile community and a serial entrepreneur. He was the first in the world to build an AI bot and mobile video game, and was responsible for applications from Rovio, known for Angry Birds, and Big Fish that are used by millions of people worldwide. Also, he holds the world record for number one hits in the App Store. Wiebe has studied and worked in 6 countries. 20 years ago, he relocated to Silicon Valley, where he has been running startups leading to exits from $500 million to IPOs of $1.2 billion. As a CEO and advisor. Last but not least, Wiebe is the co-author of the book The Secret of Silicon Valley, as well as a book on cortisol. My name is Eric. I'm a senior partner at Taito, and today I'm joined by Chantal, who's also a senior partner at Taito.
Yes, thank you, Eric, and welcome to the Scaling Without Borders podcast, Wiebe. Nice to have you. And to start off our conversation, so you started off your career at Nokia, ultimately running a billion-dollar business. So what are the most important things you've learned there about scaling up? Could you share that with us?
Yeah, it's thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Yeah, Nokia was we rode the wave, and I had a great time. I loved the company culture, working with the Finns. But what we really learned, and the iPhone arrived after I left the company. But what I really learned was that it's about the people. And usually, you know, you can point fingers at Android or iPhone, but it was really the mismanagement of key decisions at Nokia that made the downfall. And the other thing is, it's about accountability and hiring the best people. And the one of the elements was, you know, it's hard to attract talent to Helsinki and have the world's top talent move there. I think that was one of the advantages of, and still is, of Silicon Valley, that, you know, what we see is you get the best people from everywhere. I think about half the founders with a decent startup have been born outside the US. So.
Thanks. And in 2006, you were ahead of time, it seems like, with your startup Roam Hero. Also, the dot-com crash prevented you from getting any funding, which meant the end of the company. Did that impact your view on growing businesses?
Absolutely. It was, I ran into a wall. We had a great product, a great business agreements with 120 partners around the world, and ran out of funding. This was when the crisis, the 07 crisis hit. And yeah, when that's your first startup, and a lot of people are already questioning, why the heck are you leaving you know, a career in a multinational, and you've been shipped around the world, and you know, traveled first in business class, and then all of a sudden you decide to go into early stage startup and you fail. Yeah, that then you start questioning yourself for sure. But yeah, it's what I love. I really found that coming from an entrepreneurial family on both sides, it's really the joy of starting something new, and this high energy level is contagious.
Okay, well, it's great that you are also like willing to share your lessons with other entrepreneurs who are maybe just have started their journey. And also in your book, The Secret of Silicon Valley, you describe 19 lessons what we can learn from successful entrepreneurs and other companies in the Valley. So, of course, we're not going to cover all the 19 lessons, but we can discuss some interesting insights you've shared. So already the cover mentions that in Europe, you tank diesel and in Silicon Valley, rocket fuel. So that really indicates that in the Valley, everything moves a lot faster. I think you even describe it as the fifth gear. So what kind of attitude do European or Dutch entrepreneurs need to keep up with that speed, or how can they even outpace it?
Yeah, and it's, I'm still Dutch. So even though I haven't lived there for many, many years, I understand now, even though coming from an entrepreneurial family, that it's Western Europe, and I'm generalizing, obviously, but it's a very risk-averse culture. And yeah, growing up, it wasn't very sexy to run businesses. On top of that, you have, I think, the lack of open-mindedness. You have, also a lot more jealousy, honestly, than in Silicon Valley. And like everybody else, I started my career, after university, after graduating. You go for the rat race to get a prestigious career. You look at your income. You look at, oh, I want a nice lease car, and that's what you start to not only you and yourself, but also the peer pressure starts to go that way. And it's at the end of the day, what I've noticed is, and this is not, I'm generalizing, obviously, but at the end of the day, what I've seen in large companies is a lot of people are just keeping their seat warm and working. Their primary goal is their career and not the health of the company or the growth of the company. So you start moving paperclips around your desk, and it's just detrimental for innovation. And by the way, and this is not something that's unique to Europe, this is happening everywhere. This is happening with the Japanese companies that were, growing like popcorn after the Second World War. This is about even the big companies here in the Valley. Google has had its best days of innovation years ago. Now they innovate through acquiring, 20, 30, 40, 50 startups a year. So that's the hard part. The speed is unique. I find it really hard to explain. When you have folks who come here for a visit and just visit companies for a week and they go back home, do they get an idea of what the speed in Silicon Valley is? Totally not. An example is I used to have, back in the day, I used to have two full-time assistants. Now I have zero because it just slows me down. And it's about getting stuff done. And I don't have to show off to anybody. It's all that counts is the result.
Do you believe Silicon Valley is still the holy grail then, especially for tech companies, or does the European market offer enough potential as well?
So potential has always been there, but what a lot of people don't understand is, and a lot of media actually are reporting on the so-called exodus. Yes, there have been people moving from San Francisco to Austin, Texas, but at the end of the day, Silicon Valley is stronger than ever. The market share, when you look at invested dollars, Silicon Valley is stronger than even 10, 20 years ago. And Europe has just been popping up on the radar in the last 10 years. Like when I visited Europe in the, around, let's say 2008, 2012, there wasn't much going on in startup investments. And that's what you really need to build an ecosystem. On top of that, I'll give you another example. Just after our book, I visited Europe and I met with a partner at I think it was Sequoia in Paris and or London, and she was super happy and super excited how amazing Europe was doing and obviously their fund was doing. But then I asked, like, hey, have you looked at the numbers of your market share as European investments? They've grown, obviously. They might have doubled or tripled. But have you looked at how that compares to Silicon Valley? Because what she didn't realize was that in that same period of time that she saw tremendous growth, Silicon Valley had been outpacing her. So Europe has, even in the last few years, lost market share to Silicon Valley.
That's some incredible insights. Thanks. You already mentioned that the European in general tend to be more risk averse, while the American entrepreneurs seem to think bigger. How can entrepreneurs make sure they think and act bigger instead of throwing up hurdles for an international expansion?
Yeah, the short answer is there's what we call, or what I call at least, the Silicon Sherpas. So there's people who've been there, done that. And you go into any coffee shop in Palo Alto or San Mateo, you'll find dozens of people who are way smarter and more experienced than I am, and they're happy to help. So there's really this culture of paying it forward, and they just connect with them. Don't just jump on the plane back and say, hey, now I understand Silicon Valley because I've been there. Build those long-term connections, and those people are willing to help you to grow your company and to de-risk it. And one other thing that I forgot to mention in your last point is the latest stat is pretty insane, that shows also how far Europe is behind. Like back to, you know, compared to my Nokia days, when Nokia used to be the number one tech company in the world, right? And that's only 20 years ago. So the latest stat, 86% of tech companies by market cap, 86% are in the US, in the top 50. So that's just, it's mind blowing. So yes, Europe has a lot of catching up to do.
And so in terms of being serious about your business and really scaling up and make it like a huge enterprise, so would you say then European entrepreneurs should go to the US as soon as possible and not wasting time here? Or is that too
long? I would say in most cases nowadays, it's much more accepted to be remote, not just with dev teams or but even your management. So I don't think the answer is to pack your bags and move to Silicon Valley. It's possible, and might de-risk your company for a bit, but I don't see any issue with staying in Europe, as long as you have Silicon Valley representatives on your boards of directors and on your advisory board. Okay. So pay these people in equity or cash, and take advantage of all these, you know, thousands of mistakes these people have made, instead of reinventing the wheel. Because you become, after, if you've done this work for almost 20 years and working with startups, I do that next to my full-time job, and I've been doing that for a long time on boards and having coffee every week with new CEOs, and you start to see patterns, right? And you don't have to be here all the time. But I think the difference, and this is, by the way, confirmed by a study that we refer to in our book by a professor at Berkeley, who says the companies that will prevail are the ones who have the best connections to Silicon Valley, regardless of where you're located.
Okay. So we also seen that the majority of startups in the Netherlands, so they don't raise venture capital. So how realistic is it for these tech companies to achieve large-scale international growth with bootstrapping alone?
Yeah, there's exceptions. Don't get me wrong. And there's some really successful exceptions. But in general, the 80-20 rule is doesn't make any sense. We call it being on a Formula One track as a tricycle, basically, when you try to bootstrap your business. It might be look good on your cap table. You don't have any loans or that, but at the end of the day, in Silicon Valley, it is about speed. And we know that if you can fund your growth externally, you can grow a lot faster. And we've seen a lot of examples, even great European examples, where they got outpaced, not in the so much in the marketplace in the early days, but because a competitor raised more funds than they did in Silicon Valley, then they can throw more oil on the fire and grow faster than the European competitor. And even though the Silicon Valley competitor might have started 3 years later, they will still beat them because of the faster growth.
Yeah, so it's basically all about becoming the biggest, the fastest, and then you ultimately win the game, right? Yeah. So also, we know that like angel investors have a really important role in the Silicon Valley community. And you also talk about the PayPal angels or the Salesforce mafia. So, well, we don't really have these in the Netherlands. So how do you get to this network as a Dutch or European company if you would like to leverage that for your own growth?
Right. Yeah, we call that the one-eyed man in the land of the blind. So anybody who has worked for a couple of years at Google in Mountain View and moves back to Europe, they call themselves startup experts, even though they've never worked for a startup. So it's kind of funny that you when you climb Mount Everest, you wouldn't even attempt it without a Sherpa. And the same, you know, if you would to climb the Valse Berg, you would at least pick up a map somewhere. The funny thing about European startups is they don't even look at the blueprints or the playbooks that have been written here in Silicon Valley. I speak every month to investors that haven't even heard of the latest templates in Silicon Valley, and that's their full-time job, right? So it's about finding the answer to your question is it's about finding those people in Silicon Valley who've done it for years or decades and have made all those mistakes, and connect with them, because that's where the knowledge is. And it doesn't matter whether it's in machine learning, whether it's in conflict between founders, you name it, Silicon Valley has been through it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of experience and knowledge right there we can tap into. So also, you just refer to pay it forward, the pay it forward culture, right? Where like entrepreneurs that have been very successful also invest back in the ecosystem. So you don't see this happening a lot in Europe yet. So how do you think we can embrace this principle more?
Yeah, it's all about execution and about helping each other forward. Because you don't have that breeding ground, that environment that is super friendly. So it makes sense to work together even with CEOs that are not in your business, but just to share experiences and to help each other. And that culture, you see it in some places. I think Paris has done a great job in the last few years. I mean, even 10 years, as recent as 10 years ago, there wasn't much there. I've seen it in places like Helsinki, with a lot of co-working spaces and also in angels who had exits invest in new startups and mentoring or sitting on the board of these new companies. But yeah, there's a lot of examples where one startup on the other side of Amsterdam doesn't even communicate with a startup who might only be 10 kilometers or 5 miles away, whereas in Silicon Valley you'd see a lot of cooperation around the Bay Area, even though the distances are as vast as Greater London or the Randstad in the Netherlands.
So is there a stronger sense of community there? Does that like facilitate that bonding and cooperation we don't see here?
Yeah, I think it's also fear. It's definitely, we have fear. There's all kinds of syndromes that we have. We have what we call the floating duck syndrome. We have the imposter syndrome. But in order to manage that fear, it really helps if you find like-minded people. So I would definitely encourage the founders in Europe to seek out their peers.
Yeah, talking about founders, especially in the bit longer term and about scaling abroad, how important is it that the founder stays on board of the company? Or what is a good time to do an exit and actually leave the company as well?
Depends. The company goes through various stages and requires a different type of leadership. And an example is obviously Steve Jobs. And now you're kind of dealing with a logistics guy, Tim. And that has shown on the, I think it clearly shows on the innovation roadmap of Apple over the last 10 years. So I would argue that even for established companies like Apple, right, that's now been, Apple's been around, 50 years or so, almost, that even for those companies to stay on top of their game, and this is an example of a company that's done really well with a logistics operations guy at the helm, but the to have that product visionary is critical. And if you don't have it, and same with Google, by the way, when you don't have that anymore, it shows in the lack of innovation, and then it takes startups. So back to when do you push, or when does this, so we rather not push founders out only if they really don't perform. In that sense, Silicon Valley is relatively founder friendly compared to Europe. Europe likes to put a lot of terms in their funding rounds that are not founder friendly. So they're great examples of that. So I do think it helps if the founder is willing to grow and morph into new leadership roles. You want to keep those founders as long as possible because they are really understand the company and they are a big chunk of the DNA.
Yeah. Just ahead of this podcast, we chatted about the difference between a startup and a scale-up, and actually that the wording scale-up maybe doesn't even exist in Silicon Valley. Can you elaborate a little bit on that as well?
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the term before, and I think it's really the level of going through different stages depends very much on the startup. I cannot give you a number, honestly. It very much depends on the leadership. Doesn't necessarily depend on the revenue or the growth or the funding. So, but I'd like to talk about startups because wherever you are in your journey, it's still very risky. And I do notice that most countries in Europe put too much emphasis on scale-ups versus startups, because the ones that really need the help are the startups and not so much the scale-ups.
So before you talked about that it's really important to connect with advisors, right? You know, to in every coffee shop in Silicon Valley, you can find like really smart people who are able to help you and also like minimize risks. So an important piece of advice you give in the book as well is that founders, especially when their company is growing fast, you should not let thrift deceive wisdom. Also, you mentioned like, okay, they are really reluctant to share stock options or stocks for that matter with external advisors that could really, well, bite them or, well, that could really turn out negative on the long term. Could you explain that?
Yeah, penny wise, pound foolish, right? And it's, you know, if you're that ambitious that you want to take over the world and you want $100 million exit, then why are you then? Hopefully I'm not offending people, but there's a saying that if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. And you have a really high caliber of people here. And why would you not remunerate them properly? And I'll give you an example, and a lot of people don't realize that until they've seen so many startups and you start to see those patterns. You could be in a meeting with an expert in your category for half an hour, and you might get a piece of advice that changes your go-to-market strategy and might eventually generate that piece of advice in 2 years might generate $10 million in value for your company. They don't seem to realize that that comes from that one person they had coffee with. And that person might just be a coffee meeting or it might be a person on your advisory board. But it really helps to take care of these people, because why would somebody who has a coffee meeting with you and is not long-term vested in your company, why would they be all going all out for your company? They won't. And so yes, people are holding back in their first coffee meetings until, and I think that's fair, until you go all in with them. And that, as I said, doesn't have to be full time. Could be an hour call a month.
So we've covered already some lessons from your book, The Secret of Silicon Valley. But it was published around 3 years ago, right after the pandemic. And to me, at least, it feels like a totally different world already. So would you change anything with the knowledge you've gained over the last couple of years?
Yeah, usually you have to update, and the book has gone through a couple of prints, so you would usually have to rewrite some pieces, and we're actually surprised. And then one of the what we discussed earlier is the fact that Europe has fallen farther behind, even though everybody's happy because the numbers year over year look so good. But it's the lessons, and this book is not just for Europe. I mean, you could do a startup in Houston, Texas, or in Singapore, and the same rules apply. But Europe, I would say that the lessons still stand, and yeah, that's the it helps to like we one of the lessons we have in our book is it really helps because of some of the regulations in Europe and the taxes are holding you back from sharing the wealth that because it is high risk, right? Why would somebody go for less than half the market rate, work for you? They don't do their 36 hours a week, and all they get is a few shares that might end up in you know buying some coffee in 10 years. That's not fair, right? When the founders walk away with or without a lot of money, right? Then still the risk is very high even for founders. But to share that, I mean, we'd like to provide stock options to all employees. A lot of European companies make that almost impossible. So for that reason, it does help to stay in Europe with your company, and put the top company, as we call it, as a C corp in Delaware. And the subsidiary is in your local country, with the IP can stay in Europe too. So you're basically making it easier for investors and also for tax purposes to de-risk your company.
Those are some interesting insights. Thank you. So in your amazing career, you had some great successes, but also some downfalls. Did you learn more about scaling up from the mistakes or from the things that went perfect?
Yeah, the mistakes. And, you know, it's not funny. It still hurts. So, and there are small mistakes and big mistakes. But yeah, I mean, you just have to go on and show grit. You go down 10 times and you stand back up. It's hard. It's not just hard on yourself. It's hard on your family. It's hard on your friends. But that's what it takes, and that's the real lesson. If you really like it, you could keep doing this, but it requires a lot of energy. But it's tough. It's not for the faint of heart.
Okay. So before we just touched upon like what characteristics like European entrepreneurs would need to succeed when, you know, making their company international and scaling up. So you also talk about grit. So could you explain what that is and how that could help entrepreneurs on their journey?
Yes, there's a famous psychologist. I'm blanking on her name. I think at Penn University, who wrote the book on grit and showed that it's one of the key variables in success of people, not just in the workplace but in general. And it shows that you persevere, and that struggle that you have helps you grow. And this doesn't just apply to startups, but it's definitely visible, very visible in startups and particularly in Silicon Valley. I would say that for Europe, apart from grit, what would help is slightly different decision making models sometimes that people are not used to. One is the 1 and 2 door decisions. So agree to disagree. And just state it out loud and put it in the minutes. It's totally fine, but don't wait for consensus, because you're going to wait forever. As we all know, in most European countries are very consensus driven. I lived in Sweden. That's probably the most consensus, one of the most consensus driven countries in Europe. And you're waiting forever, and it's not helpful. So what you need to do is agree to disagree, and then check, is the decision a 1 or 2 door decision? And this idea originated from Andy, who used to be a CEO at Intel decades ago, and was implemented by Bezos at Amazon. But what it does is it forces you, okay, if this is a reversible, what we call a 2-door decision, you can go back through the same door. It's a reversible decision. You have lost opportunity costs. There's got some other costs involved, and there might be a lot of emotion involved. But at the end of the day, there's not much damage done. That's a 2-door decision. Those decisions should be made in days, not in weeks or months. And that's the case. Even startups I meet, they sometimes go months and months before making a 2-door decision. A 1-door decision is, hey, I'm going to quit my job, or hey, I'm going to break up my relationship. There's no way back, or very rarely. So, yeah, but that goes back to the speed, right? That you realize is that you don't need everybody all in. You can put a timeline and say, hey, you disagree. It's noted. We have to hit this particular milestone in 3 months. If we don't hit it, we go back through that door and we just have a party.
Yeah, I can see how that all ties in with the whole risk averse thing, right? If you don't yep. take risk and don't, you're not able to take any quick decisions and to move forward in the way that's needed to grow, right?
And at the end, it's about fear, right? It's about fear not to upset other people or your career, and you just start keep pushing paperclips on your desk until the cows come home.
Yeah, that doesn't help anybody.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think we've come to the end of our podcast. So thank you, Wiebe, for giving us an insight into your world in the Valley. And I hope it's really useful for entrepreneurs who are listening. And well, we've now heard what they need to be able, well, to succeed, or what contributes to them succeeding, like speed, of course, like a great network, connections, and well, last but not least, of course, grit, we just talked about. Well, I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. If you want to know more about scaling up, tune in for other episodes in this series. And if you have any feedback on this episode, contact the Taito team on LinkedIn or comment on the video. And you can also drop us an email at hello@taitopr.com. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.